I don't think he's coming back today, but we can hold it over if you want. All right.
Cool.
All right, the Senate Committee on Human Services will come to order. Thank you all so much for being here today. We are going out of order on the agenda, so just to give you a little roadmap of our plan today, we're going to start with House Bill 3222A. We will then move on to House Bill 2599A, unless Representative Buckley gets here first. Then we'll go to House Bill 3323, and then we will move to the work session on House Bill 2394A. Cheyenne, we need to carry over to Thursday the work sessions on House Bill 2889A and House Bill 2890A. They aren't quite ready to go today. We're still getting the final nuts and bolts cleaned up on those amendments. But everything else we will move through today. I do not expect that we will do any work sessions on any of the public hearing and possible work sessions that we have today, just so that we can keep moving through. And we're putting the inclusionary zoning at the end because I know there are a lot of you here today that want to talk about it, and that way we can give the full balance of the time to that issue while still getting through the rest of the agenda. Does that work for the committee?
Good boss.
Great. And
keep in mind, I have my 4 o'clock, so.
Again?
Supposedly we have the final amendments today.
All right, and we'll lose Senator Cruz at 4 o'clock. I don't take it personally, so neither should any of you. And Senator Dimbrough will be here at about 3:15. He is at a ceremony at the governor's office right now. All right, I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3222A.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3222A requires Land Conservation and Development Commission to order a local government, state agency, or special district to take action necessary to bring its comprehensive plan, land use regulations, limited land use decisions, or other land use decisions into compliance if its standards, conditions, and procedures are subjective or discourage needed housing through unreasonable cost or delay. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact. This came off of the House, out of the House Committee 7L, off the House floor, 580, and there is a dash A5 amendment which requires local government approvals that are necessary to develop needed housing if the application is consistent with the comprehensive plan and applicable regulations. Requires local governments to allow amendment of applications not consistent with comprehensive plans or applicable regulations, and requires local governments denial of applications not able to be made consistent via amendment or conditions.
Great. Thank you very much. We've got John Chandler and Aaron Doyle, please. And we'll let John kick us off. It's John Chandler Day in the Senate Committee.
Hardly wait, Madam Chair, members of the committee. John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here on behalf of HB 3222A. And this is a wonderful introduction for this committee on the intricacies of Oregon land use. I was talking with one of you earlier today and pointed out that there's really two presentations on this bill. One is good bill should pass, and the other is a 20-minute dive into land use arcana. Basically what this bill does, and the Dash 6 amendments are also on OLIS, and I realize you're not going to be working those today, but if your permission, Madam Chair, I'll go ahead and talk about those as well. Bill does two things. One, let me back up a second. Oregon law for 30 years, if not longer, has required cities and counties in the land use context to have a clear and objective path for needed housing. In other words, they had to have one process on their books that said, if you do the following things, the following sequence, you're good to go. If once they have that, then they can have as many discretionary paths, be that a planned unit development or some other process that isn't clear and objective. They can have as many of those as they want, but they're required by law to have a clear and objective path. I discovered, frankly, this session, to my dismay, that not even though it's been on the books for years and years and years, not all cities have that clear and objective path anymore. They did when their comprehensive plans were acknowledged, but that has been eroded. Nobody's fault. It just happened. So the point of the bill in front of you, it's not the Dash 6 amendment, I'll speak about that in a minute, the bill that came over from the House, is simply to add the lack of clear and objective standards to the LCDC's enforcement authority. And LCDC's had enforcement authority for years. It gets used very rarely. It gets local government's attention when it does. It's basically a proceeding at the Land Conservation and Development Commission where if a jurisdiction is violating one of the provisions which are set out in the language in front of you that violate the land use law, they can actually have a tribunal and talk about why that's happening and what the remedies might be. By adding clear and objective standards to that, it'll allow us to go talk to those jurisdictions that don't have their ordinances in compliance with state law and try to get them there. It's going to be very important. This deals with needed housing, which is a term of art in land use. It means housing for the the community. All income levels, all types of housing, manufactured, multifamily, single family. They have to have whatever their planning has said they need, they have to have a way to get that, and they have to have at least one clear and objective path. So that's part one of the bill, Madam Chair and members, is to allow LCDC to weigh in. And LCDC can weigh in now under current law if their approval processes violate clear and objective standards, but because, I assume, because it was in the statutes, we didn't figure it was necessary, there was just simply a gap that allowed us to go to LCDC if they didn't have the rules on the books in the first place.
John, can you give an example of what a clear and objective path would be?
8 units the acre in an 8-unit zone with setbacks of 10 feet on either side. It could be a whole number. It could be a range of things, Madam Chair.
And what would an unclear and non-objective?
Compatible with the neighborhood.
Okay, thanks.
So, or planned unit development where you get to move units around. You're going to achieve the same density, but instead of having it be traditional, more rectangular lots in a rectangular pattern, you might have curvilinear streets, you might have some wetlands issues, you may have some other stuff that you have to use more discretion and more actual planning as the permit goes forward versus something that is just simply do the following 17 steps.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
That does. Thank you.
If you don't mind, I can talk about the dash sixes, or would you prefer to wait?
There's
on
dash sixes in addition to dash fives?
They're the same thing as
okay.
That. They're identical except for LC did some the instead of the, frankly,
okay.
Form and substance stuff.
My apologies, Madam Chair, Committee. There is a dash six. It reorders
yes,
section two, so the definitions are first, and it rewords, but it's to the same effect as the dash A5.
They're okay. Identical in outcome. They're simply different in wording, and that's an LC thing. Not,
and do we have that here?
They're on OLIS.
They're on OLIS, okay. But not at the DICE.
Oh, I have it in DICE. Did I get yours?
I have the five.
For purpose of this conversation?
Oh, I found it. It's behind the five, as six often is. Thank you.
Well, for purpose of this discussion, the five will work just fine. This is another, I apologize in advance, another deep dive. Back in, I think, 95 or 97, we moved a bill through this legislature on the issue of needed housing. And basically what the law said, what we thought the law said, was jurisdictions have to approve needed housing subject to regional conditions. In other words, trying to get clear that within urban growth boundaries, land that is zoned for residential use had to be approved, that the jurisdictions didn't have the ability to deny. And that was very important to us, very important to make sure affordable housing and other forms of housing get built. That we went along just fine. That, like I say, was over 20 years ago, until a few years ago when the Land Use Board of Appeals did their job, frankly, and found that the language that I just told you about when we added that to the statute was in a bill dealing with moratoria. And according to LUBA, then, the only time you could use that language and say the jurisdictions couldn't deny had to approve subject to reasonable standards was if it applied to moratoria, which is a very, very limited. There's only been about 3 more development moratorium in Oregon in the last 25 years. So what the dash sixes will do is take the language that is currently in the law, reworded and reworked to address some city concerns about a recent U.S. Supreme Court case, and make it applicable to all land use actions affecting needed housing, not just those that arise in the context of a development moratorium. I told you it would be complicated. I should have gone with good bill should pass, huh?
I guess the concern that I have is when the bill was referred to the committee, it was described as a bill that passed the House very easily, carried by a haiku with Representative
yes.
Gilliam. We aren't a land use committee, so it makes me a little bit nervous to expand into a whole other area that was never vetted by a land use committee to be put in only by concurrence. I mean, it just seems like an expansion of what I had understood that we were going to do. I thought that the amendment was just going to be a cleanup of 3222 rather than opening up a brand new conversation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But to give you the background noise there, we worked on the same amendment language, or essentially the same amendment concept with slightly different language changes, with the cities on the House side. And we're ready to move it, I think, to the dash fours. And pulled at the last minute because of a cross-reference concern we had to some building code statutes in Representative Clem's committee. So the conversation with the local governments, who are the parties really affected by this, took place over there as well. So even though I'm not wasn't quite sure why this bill ended up in a non-land use committee myself, it really isn't a change from what the conversations were on the House side. And we made sure the House committee knew that these conversations were taking place, that this amendment wasn't being not moved on the House because of a problem is not being moved to grant up against the deadline, and didn't have time to address that one random referendum cross-reference issue.
And if for some reason this committee chose not to move this amendment, would bad things happen if we waited for a committee that could, of a more appropriate background to look at? I mean, are there bad things that will happen if we just move the base bill?
Oh, bad things always happen if amendments aren't added to bills, Madam Chair, especially my amendments. Certainly that's up to the committee. I don't think it's going to. There's no opposition to the bill, put it that way. And I'd be more than happy to work it here if you'd like to refer it to a different to Representative Senator Edwards. I suppose that'd be the other place. That's your discretion. The base bill can stand alone. I think these amendments are important just simply because it fixes that Lubick problem, the disconnect. And the background noise actually for this came up during the affordable housing work group we had when we found out about a project that in Southern Oregon that had been denied, even though it met the city zoning, and that shouldn't have happened. That's kind of when I found out that certain things weren't being followed. So, and found this LUBA issue on the books. I don't think, and I'll defer to Ms. Doyle, I think the cities are fine with the amendment as being proposed, not necessarily thrilled about them, but fine with them. In terms of technical expertise, I'm not sure Senator Edwards' committee is going to be any more up to speed on this level of fine-toothing.
And we're not moving it today, so we have time to get more.
Careful what committees you're talking about.
Well, quite so, except for Senator Olson, who's all over it.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I might suggest, I'm fine with this, and I think I do understand it, that you might check with Representative Clem.
Right.
And just make sure that everything is going the way it was intended. So.
Okay. Thank you very much.
We're glad to take questions.
Why don't we hear from the city first, and then we'll go back to questions.
Thank you. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, for the record, Aaron Doyle on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. As Mr. Chandler indicated, we have been talking about this since the House side. The original bill is introduced, actually had this. It was amended to pull this part out because of drafting issues and long, arduous negotiations between him and myself and the city attorneys that are working on these issues. One of the big things is that there was a Supreme Court decision that within the last few years that could have left us open to some significant liabilities if it had worked the way it was originally drafted, and we appreciate his consideration of that. We don't love the bill. We think we're pretty good at doing things locally and working with our developers to get their applications passed, but understand that there is a perceived need for this and are willing and therefore worked on this amendment. It's heavily negotiated, addresses a lot of our concerns. We don't believe one of the issues that has been raised, but I don't believe actually can occur under this new language, is that once an application is submitted and we go through the process of seeking an amendment, which is part of that. I don't have the amendment out in front of me, but it's subsection 2 of section 3, the last time I saw it. That's not going to allow an applicant to continuously come back to the Apple and try and rework their application without just being told that at a certain point your application will not meet city requirements that are established in our comprehensive plans. And therefore, if you want to develop this parcel, you're going to have to come back with a new application. But I do think that there is a need for cities to work locally with developers and to make sure that their applications standards are clear. And from there, if there are changes that they want to see to how things are developing, they have to do those through the land use system, and that's through the amending the comprehensive plan or other sorts of plans. This amendment is still it's difficult, but I think it is something that cities can accomplish and will accomplish through ongoing processes that they have in place. And given that we can also ask for an extension of the deadline, that we have to determine does this application pass muster? With that ability to extend that deadline, we can get to a point where we can make a final decision that is actually based on the local comprehensive plan and land use regulations that we have in place in order to make sure that development is occurring the way that the community agreed to pursuant to our land use planning. I'm also happy to answer any questions at this time.
Madam Chair, if I might, and to your concern about this being a new development, as Ms. Doyle has indicated, the base bill had this language in it. So we had the initial hearing on the House side with this or similar language. We then went to work on amendments to that language based on the concern that the cities had, and I agree with their concerns, under the Kuntz case, which is the U.S. Supreme Court case, it extended takings liability beyond the traditional forms of Nolan and Dolan. And when we got done with that rewriting, and brought the amendment, that's when that cross-reference to the building code statutes came up, which is why we pulled it. So this was in front of the House committee, at least in concept, if not in the precise language. So they, Senator Representative Clem may or may not recall that, but he got to hear an earful of it during the House proceedings.
So the cities prefer the bill with the dash sixes adopted to it?
Chair Gelser, honestly, no. But we will live with the dash sixes. It is heavily negotiated. It's addresses most of the concerns that we have. It's just, you know, any changes in law make us very nervous when it comes to land use and the ability to appeal anything.
And that's specific to the dash six, or that's the bill as a whole?
With the base bill as it came over from the House side, it's very difficult for us to argue that statute on the books that's been on the books for 30 years shouldn't be enforced. Excuse me. Therefore, we didn't put any opposition to that. This is a more of a very, very squishy, we don't like it, but we'll live with it, with the dash six.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Are there other questions for this panel? Nobody? All right.
Thank you
both very much. Is there anybody else that would like to be heard on House Bill 3222? Are you raising your hand or no? Okay. So I am going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3222A. And did Representative Buckley come in? No? And have we heard that he's coming? So why don't I go on to the next one? Will you call them and see?
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to open up. We're going to call Representative Buckley, so we're going to jump ahead to House Bill 3323, opening a public hearing on House Bill 3323A.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3323A allows Type B area agencies and service areas with a population of 650,000 or more to bring civil action for physical or financial abuse of vulnerable persons, declares emergency effective on passage. There's no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact, and the background section of the staff measure summary defines what a Type B area agency is. This comes out of House committee with one no vote and off the House floor with 15 no votes.
Thank you very much. Patrick Henry and Chris Fick, please. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm, for the record, Patrick Henry. I'm with the Multnomah County Attorney's Office. Among my assignments, I represent the Department of County Human Services, which includes the Aging and Disability Services Program and the Adult Protective Services Unit. Multnomah County is a Type B area agency on aging, which means that it conducts protective services investigations and provides other services for elderly people. We regularly see cases involving financial exploitation and physical and emotional abuse of elderly people. House Bill 3323 adds to the resources that we have available to us to seek perpetrator accountability of elder abuse by seeking civil penalties against them, up to $25,000 per occurrence. This is the existing law permits the District Attorney's Office, the Department of Justice, and the Department of Human Services to file these civil claims against elder abuse perpetrators. This bill simply adds a Type B agency, actually Multnomah County specifically, to the list of entities that are able to bring elder abuse actions against perpetrators of elder abuse. An issue that has been raised that I want to address briefly has to do with the potential impact of this bill on elderly people being able to file claims on their own behalf. This bill does not impact a individual's right to seek damages or redress on their own behalf. The elderly people would not, or a vulnerable person would not be a party to the action that was filed against the Type B agency, and therefore their rights would not be impacted in any way. They would be able to file an action, seek damages on their own behalf, and would not be impacted by an action filed by our office. As a practical matter, these cases would be triaged carefully. the best avenue for perpetrator accountability, obviously, is a criminal action filed by the district attorney's office. If the district attorney were able to take a case involving elder abuse, obviously that would be ideal. But these cases involve proof difficulties and open the door to potentially seeking redress against people who commit elder abuse when there isn't sufficient evidence to meet the very exacting criminal standard. And it would not impact individuals' ability to seek redress in their own behalf. Thank you.
Madam Chair, other members of the committee, for the record, Chris Fick, also with Multnomah County. The only context I wanted to provide is why this is a Multnomah County-only bill. This issue and idea actually arose in 2013. We approached the other area agencies on aging at that time, but due to some concerns that they didn't have the capacity and expertise to handle these sort of civil cases, they decided that they did not want to seek this authority. It's our hope that by granting this authority just to Multnomah County, we'll gather some information about the actual caseload and workload and our success rate and be able to share that with other area agencies on aging in case they want to pursue this expanded authority as well.
Thank you very much. Senator Cruz.
So I'm obviously economies of scale here in the different agencies. So the smaller ones are fine with the Attorney General handling it. Is that where these cases are dealt with at this point?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, that's correct. In most areas of the state, the protective services function is actually performed by the state, and they're represented by the Department of Justice.
Right.
So that typically would be the avenue that a case like this would be targeted.
So if I could, Madam Chair, so basically this is a resource-driven issue is why you're wanting the authority for a much larger, last time I checked, I think Portland's bigger than Roseburg, so.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, that's correct. It is a matter of
For now.
Adding additional resources.
Right.
Yeah, thank you.
Do you know what it was that drove that number of no votes? Did anybody express what that opposition was based on? It looks like it did not have an insignificant number of no votes on the House floor.
Chair Gilser, Representative McLean raised a number of questions that Patrick has done his best to address about whether or not a senior could still sue on their own behalf. And due to some questions about that, that's the primary source of the number of no votes. We are following up with his office to make sure he gets answers to those questions.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair.
Senator Wilson.
How many cases do you anticipate this will generate?
That's a good question, Madam Chair. Senator Wilson, it won't be very many at first. These cases are going to require a commitment of some resources. We are not going to hire additional attorneys or staff to be able to handle these cases. So the overall bandwidth that we have to file the cases is not going to be enormous. So it will be a handful of cases, I think, initially. And I think as Chris indicated, you know, we'll be in kind of a testing phase and testing mode to see if we can handle these cases efficiently and effectively.
Follow up. How will you seek these cases out?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, one of the best sources of cases will be the Protective Services Unit actually is a part of Multnomah County. And the Protective Services Unit, the District Attorney's Office, the Portland Police, Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, we meet regularly, actually on a monthly basis, and we staff difficult cases that the Protective Service Unit workers bring to the table. They bring specific cases to bounce them off of me, to bounce them off of the public guardian, the district attorney, and it is in that environment that we oftentimes staff cases with the district attorney, and we learned that because of some difficulty with evidence issues, the district attorney doesn't believe they can meet the criminal standard. And just to give you an example of what that might look like, some of these cases would involve people who are suffering from some level of cognitive impairment, and they would absolutely be critical in a criminal investigation or criminal prosecution to be able to testify on their own behalf. And in cases where people are not able to remember or they're not able to actually say exactly how a financial transaction occurred, for instance, those can't be prosecuted criminally, but there is enough evidence in terms of the relationship between the parties and other kinds of things that we could meet a preponderance of the evidence standard that we would need to meet on the civil side.
Follow up.
So you already do this. This is just an expansion from the type A into a type B area agency?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, we don't have the specific authority to seek civil penalties. What we do in those cases is we are actually making a pitch, or the Protective Services people are making a pitch to the district attorney to seek a criminal prosecution. At this point, when we learn that they can't meet the criminal standard, we don't actually have, my office doesn't have the authority under current law to seek a civil penalty in lieu of the criminal prosecution. And that's what this bill is seeking to achieve.
Follow up. That being the case, then, you certainly must have tracked the number of cases that you have seen that you cannot charge criminally, but you could have charged civilly. Do you not keep a record of, you know, put on a chalkboard, there's number six, there's number seven, or...
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I'm not aware of the Protective Services Unit does track those cases and does track the number of investigations it conducts. I don't have available to me this afternoon that data, but we do regularly keep statistics and information about cases that have been staffed. Though I would say it's not likely that we'll be able to actually tease out the cases that were actually staffed that were determined not to be eligible for criminal prosecution. I'm not sure that we would have record or information about that. Typically, on a monthly basis, we're looking at a half dozen cases, and it's not the norm for us to see cases that actually could be prosecuted criminally that don't get prosecuted. It would be, I would say, over the course of a year, perhaps a handful of cases. It would be my guess. But, again, that's not information that I maintain.
If you could kind of encapsulate and maybe find out that sent it to the committee, I'd appreciate that.
I'll try to track that down, Senator. Right. Thank you.
And then I had, Senator Munis Anderson.
Thank you. There's a lot of... lots of types of elder abuse. I've run into several cases where it's primarily financial. A 90-year-old man won't allow his 70-year-old children to have a part of his life, be a part of his life at all, dementia. He brought in a girlfriend who was probably in her 50s and obviously took heirlooms, got his... into his bank account, et cetera, and they had real problems trying to do anything. Protective Services says there isn't anything to do, even though he probably had a little bit of dementia. Are those the types of cases that you would be taking, like that one?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, that is a good example of the kind of case that we could take. Again, assuming that they're not going to get prosecuted criminally, and assuming that the elder or their family aren't able to prosecute independent of my office, in other words, to seek an attorney, hire an attorney, and seek redress on their own behalf, that could potentially be a case that we would look at it. We could take, if you know, depending on the facts, but that certainly would be within the realm of the kind of case. Financial exploitation is certainly covered by this act, and also under current law, and physical abuse is also.
Emotional?
I'm not sure that emotional abuse is actually included as a... it needs to be either physical or financial abuse.
Why are... it talks about vulnerable persons. Why are people with intellectual and developmental disabilities excluded?
You know, Madam Chair, I've actually been fairly loose the way I've been using language. I keep referring to this being an issue for elderly. It also includes people with cognitive impairments. The definition is the same definition as you would find in a public guardian proceeding. The person is incapacitated, and it provides a definition for what incapacitated means. So it does include people who are vulnerable because of cognitive impairments. It's not simply age-based.
Although in the Oregon statute, as it relates to abuse, people with developmental intellectual disabilities aren't included in Chapter 124, which is what this refers to. I think they're in 435. They aren't included in this.
This particular section, Madam Chair, of Chapter 124 includes the definition of a person with a disability, and that means a person with a physical or mental impairment that is likely to continue without substantial improvement, and it prevents the performance of substantially all the ordinary duties of occupations. In other words, there is a definition in current law of a person with a disability in this particular section of Chapter 124 that is not age-based. The other sections of Chapter 124 have to do with mandatory elder abuse reporting, and that is age-based. It is for people who are 65 and older have the benefit of that protective services function.
So you are arguing that it would cover people with intellectual and developmental disabilities?
Yes. Yes, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
This is your question.
New question. In Section 2, it describes an elderly person as a person over 65 years of age, and it also defines a vulnerable person as an elderly person. So that does this bill only relate to those folks over 65? Section 2, it would be on line 24, and then on line 35, 36.
So the Madam Chair, Senator Olson, my understanding is that the current law does extend to people with disabilities, and is not. This bill does not in any way change current law as to who could be the beneficiary of a civil action. But I need a few minutes to take a look at the exact provision in current law.
You'd have to look.
I was just concerned of the fact that this. It seems to me, in Section 2 on page 2, that it refers to somebody that's an elderly person, means a person 65 years of age or older. And sometimes there are people that are incapacitated that are 59 and younger. So I'm just wondering, and they said a vulnerable person means an elderly person, which is described as a person 65 years of age or older. So my concern was, is this bill only specifically for 65 and older?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it does apply to those who are incapacitated.
Elderly person, financially incapable, incapacitated, or a person with disability. So it could be any of those.
That's correct.
It seems like there are a lot of questions about this, and I know we need to move on to the other bill. Would it be possible to work on those questions and come back on at our next hearing next Thursday if we hold this public hearing over?
I believe so.
Chair Gelser, that would be possible, yes.
Yes.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else that would like to be heard today on House Bill 3323A? No? All right. So we're going to carry the public hearing over to Thursday. We'll get back some information about the breadth of who's included. It might be helpful. Did Chris just leave? Okay. That would be great. It would be great if they could follow up with the Department of Human Services in particular to make sure who is here and maybe a statement from DHS about who is covered and who is not. I was just saying what we'd like to have back on Thursday. Okay, thank you very much. All right, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3323A. And we are going to carry over also House Bill 2599A. The sponsor isn't able to be here until a little later. And once we get into the inclusionary zoning bill, I'd like to just keep going rather than interrupting that. So if you are here for House Bill 2599A, is there anyone here for that bill that cannot come back on Thursday for that bill? For $25.99? Everybody's okay? Okay, excellent. There you are. There's a lot of people in the room. All right, so we're carrying over House Bill 2599A and opening up a public hearing on House Bill 2564A.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2564A allows local governments to affect sale price of residential housing development or designate sale to a particular class or group of purchasers, so long as no more than 30% of units are available below market rates and specified incentives are provided in exchange. There's also a dash A5 amendment received today that includes rentals. So it's not just designated sales and sales prices, it would include rental prices as well. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact on the A engrossed version of the bill. And it comes out of House Committee with 4 no votes and off the House floor with 25 no votes.
And Cheyenne, just to clarify, the bill itself that we're hearing today does not include rentals. That is
correct.
In an amendment that was submitted to the committee.
The dash A5 received
Thank
today.
You. So just to be clear in the testimony, the bill does not include rentals unless we amend it. Those two things are separate.
Mm-hmm.
Right. All right. I would like to start.
Madam Chair, is that amendment posted on the list?
It is posted.
There.
All right, so our first panel is Commissioner Dan Saltzman and Rick Jarabas. Please.
Oh, okay.
He has friends.
Absolutely.
He also had a Twinkie at lunch.
I need one. That's better.
Well, good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Portland City Commissioner Dan Saltzman, and I'm here to express the City of Portland's strong support for House Bill 2564 as amended. And as the housing commissioner, the commissioner in charge of housing in the City of Portland, I'm very pleased that you are considering repealing the ban on inclusionary zoning for residential, single-family residential. And we believe it's a very practical tool to provide local governments to come to grips with the ever escalating crisis, maybe crisis too strong a word, but deficits we're facing in the supply of affordable housing, not only in the City of Portland, but indeed throughout our state. And we believe that inclusionary zoning or lifting the preemption gives us local governments the ability to tailor solutions to our local situations. And I'm also here to say, while we support the bill as it's currently written, as it applies to new single-family residential, we're also here to ask your support for the Dash 5 amendment that would simply include rentals as well as homeownership in terms of the application of inclusionary zoning. And again, so it would be for any new rental developments or new residential developments. So that's the Dash 5 amendment, in essence, is just adding the word rental in there. 9 words, I think, is our amendment. And we think that this is a good solution, and it's something that we really need in Portland. One of the issues that we see, we just commissioned for the first time ever the State of Housing Report on the City of Portland, where we really got a good handle on what the demographics are and the affordability situation that we face in our own city. And I think it's no secret to Senator Moniz Anderson or others, Senator Dembro, that most people are being pushed out of our city. They cannot afford to rent or to buy, for that matter, inside the city limits of Portland anymore. And we need to act consciously to make sure those opportunities are there. The City of Portland, we invest our urban renewal dollars, we invest general fund dollars, we invest our federal dollars, we waive SDCs, all these things in order to encourage the supply of affordable housing. And I just wanted to show you one, and I submitted it for the record, but just one graph from the State of the Housing Report. That's an outline of the City of Portland. And if you anywhere where it's brown, means it's unaffordable, and where it's blue, it is affordable. So for a African-American household earning the median income in Portland, there's virtually no neighborhood in Portland where they can afford to rent. The same thing is practically true for average Latino households. There's probably 3 or 4 neighborhoods where they can afford to rent. And you can see for the average white neighborhood, it's different. But that's just, I think, points out the situations that we face in the City of Portland. And indeed, it's not just Portland. It's cities throughout the state of Oregon, I think, that face similar situations. So we are here to urge your support for the amendment. And I guess I will just say that the reason we so much need it in Portland is that most of our housing starts are not residential ownership. They are multifamily. In fact, last year, 75% of all new units built were multifamily rental in the city of Portland. And we feel that, as I mentioned, you know, we know that people can't afford to live in the city of Portland anymore. We want to change that. We don't want to have people that have to live far from where they work, live far from where they may choose to worship, live far from where they may wish to go to school. We want to keep those people with opportunities. We want to provide people opportunities in the city limits of Portland to live, work, and prosper. And so that's why we're asking for your support for this legislation. And the Dash 5 amendment would greatly facilitate the ability for the city of Portland to help others. And indeed, this is a collective exercise. It requires simply not just government. It does require the development community to share some responsibility, some collective responsibility. I think that's one thing we all care about, I think, is growing inequality in our society. And it's not going to be solved by one sector alone. It's going to take all of us sort of, you know, rolling up our sleeves and getting involved in this together to address these issues that we face. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions or let our other testimony first. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you.
And you have a PowerPoint,
I do.
Correct?
Can we turn that on? Is that... Great. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me. My name is Rick Jacobus, and I'm with an organization called Cornerstone Partnership, which is a nonprofit initiative that works across the country to help communities built in a way that's more sustainably mixed income. And I'm an expert in inclusionary housing. I've worked with many jurisdictions to both study the economics and the practicalities of implementation for inclusionary housing. I worked with San Francisco, with Denver, and most recently with the city of Seattle on these issues. And it's a challenging thing to produce an urban development or a way of living that is inclusive. And when Oregon has really been a leader across the country in creative land use regulations, and you've done a lot to make Oregon the kind of place that people want to live, the obvious and inevitable and result of that is that more people want to live here and it becomes more expensive. And so the question is, how do you grow in a way that makes Oregon better, but also doesn't push out the people who've been here all along by making it too expensive? And so that's a difficult balancing act, and there is a very small number of tools that are available to local communities to achieve that goal. And in my experience, among the most effective are inclusionary housing policies. There are more than 500 inclusionary housing policies across the country. They're implemented in large cities like Chicago and New York and San Francisco, but the majority of them are actually in cities or counties with less than 500,000 people. They're in suburban communities that are experiencing pressure from growing metro regions. They're in resort towns where single-family homes for the people who work there are being turned into vacation homes. And they're in farming communities where there's pressure from sort of bedroom community development for distant commuting. Where you don't see inclusionary housing, though, is in communities that aren't experiencing the pressure of growth. Inclusionary is not a policy that works everywhere. You wouldn't expect to see it everywhere, and it's not likely to be adopted in the parts of the state where there's not, where people aren't feeling the pressure from fast growth, rising home prices, et cetera. I wanted to just talk about two things, and I'm here hopefully to answer your questions about sort of how these programs work practically. A lot of my job is helping cities to do this well, to make this kind of policy really work, to achieve the policy objectives, and it requires a balancing act. I was going to just address two questions that I know everyone struggles with when this topic comes up, and the first is, do these requirements cause developers to sort of pass price increases on to their other residents in their properties. And the other is, what happens to make sure that the homeowners who buy these homes don't get some sort of a windfall over time? And I have a fairly short, but maybe too long for today, animation that sort of walks through some of the economics, and I would encourage people to look at it, but I'm going to skip a bunch of my slides and just give you the short version of it today, and you can look at it on our website and see the whole animation. But the question that comes up immediately when we raise inclusionary housing is often, well, aren't developers going to, you know, if they have to have an increased cost to provide affordable units in their project, aren't they going to pass that cost on to the market rate buyers in the same projects? And it's a legitimate question, but it requires a little bit of sort of economics class. And the question is, where do prices come from in the first place? Who sets the price when someone's building homes for sale? In my opinion, there are three basic categories of the cost of housing. There's the cost of the land, there's the cost of the construction, and then there's the developer's profit. And the construction cost includes all of the permitting and fees and architectural costs and legal costs. But these three elements interact in a way that's important to understand in order to see how inclusionary housing works. And the first thing I want to just point you to is that the market sets the price for housing. Developers will charge the most that they can given the market conditions. And so when the market prices increase in an area, developers don't sell the housing for what they originally expected to sell it for. They sell it for the new market price. And so what that means is, in the short term, developers earn an excess profit. They earn more profit than they would have needed to initiate the development in the first place. But that's a short-term change, because fairly quickly after that, the owners of land recognize that there's this excess profit, and they raise the price of land so that the developer's profits return to normal and the excess attributes to the land values. So what happens when you have a growing area is land values rise rapidly, and that's the ultimate source of the affordable housing problem. That's why it's expensive to rent and to own in a place like Portland. And the opposite happens in reverse. When the housing market drops, it squeezes developers' profits for a period of time. They earn less money than they expected to. But over time, that means they're able to bid less on land. So land prices drop. So there's a cycle that where land prices follow the demand in the housing market. But developers don't get to choose the price. They are takers of the price. So what that means for inclusionary housing is that when we have a new cost that we're imposing, that doesn't mean the developers don't have the ability to charge more. If they could have charged more, they would have in the first place if the market allowed that, right? So that what happens is developers' profits are reduced in the short term, and in the long term, land prices are, maybe they don't decline, maybe they rise less rapidly, right? It puts a downward pressure on land prices, which is the intent of these policies. And the question arises, is that fair to expect landowners to carry this cost for this broad social agenda? And the answer that I like to cite is, when the property values rise, when the market is hot, is it fair? Where do the proceeds of that go? We all pay more to live here. Who receives more? Where does that money go? It goes into the land value. So what's inclusionary housing programs recapture a piece of that increase in land value and use it to help the families and the individuals who are most impacted by the higher housing costs. So I want to also address the second question. I'm going to need to skip. Let's see if it will let me do that. This question of what happens about windfall gains. There's no doubt that when we require a developer to sell a home for less than its market price, that they feel that as a real cost. The question is, if we're selling that home to a lower or moderate or working family at less than the market price, what is their obligation down the road? How do we make sure that they're using that public resource in a way that benefits everyone? Or is it just going to benefit one family? So I want to tell you really quickly one story just to give you a real taste of a real project. So this is a house in Santa Rosa, California, which was purchased by a single mother who was a special ed teacher. Her name is Linda. For her and her son in 2005. And so Linda, as a special ed teacher, actually made a very reasonable salary. She made the kind of salary that people in earlier years would have expected to be able to own a home with her kind of income. But because of the housing market in Santa Rosa at the time, the average family like hers would only be able to afford a $250,000 house, but the average house was costing close to $600,000 at that point. So what were her options? She could buy a substandard house that needed a lot of work that she couldn't afford to do. She could move to a more affordable community. Or she could do what most people did at that point in time, is take out some very creative loan and basically buy more house than she could afford. And we all know how that ended. What Linda did instead, though, was she bought this house for $250,000. She paid a third of her income every month, basically, for her housing costs. And this was an inclusionary housing development. Her house looks like the rest of the houses in her development, but costs substantially less. So the thing is that she had to make a choice in buying this house, which is her house is resale price restricted, like the majority of the homes that are created by inclusionary housing across the country. The developers enter into a covenant. The home buyers have to agree when they get help. They get to buy it at a below market price. They will resell it at a below market price. And so in Linda's case, her price is tied to changes in the area median income. So as the incomes of people like her go up over time, the amount she can sell her house for goes up over time. And at the time she purchased it, this is the trade-off that she had to consider. House prices were rising much faster than incomes. And she had to decide, do I want this help buying a house, and is it worth giving up the potential appreciation in the market? So she bought her house, and she did it for the reason most people do, which is she wanted to live there. She wanted a place to raise her family. So she made it her own, and this is what sort of home ownership means for people. Her son got to paint his room whatever color he wanted. But when she went to sell, suddenly it was an investment, right? She was looking at, well, how did this work for her as an investment? So these are real numbers from one real transaction. This is one of the things where every program is slightly different because the markets are different in different cities. But this is just to give you a real-world example. She bought her house for $250,000. 4 years later, she moved. And the median income had risen by 7%, so she sold for 7% more, which was $17,000 in appreciation, much less than, you know, what she may have expected to have happened if she bought a market rate house. She also paid down her mortgage, so she left with $31,000. What happened in Santa Rosa during that same period of time was that the median price in her zip code dropped by $100,000. So Linda was able to move from her inclusionary house into a market rate house thanks to that $31,000. It was enough to sort of boost her into unassisted home ownership, largely because the market also came down. But the most important thing from policy is that the next family that bought her house was a moderate income family like hers. It was an EMT and another teacher. So they actually were able to buy this house at an affordable price for someone at median income. And that house has actually turned over twice since. So in 10 years, four different families have lived in this one house. And the restriction in Santa Rosa will last for 45 years. So they'll get many families in this one house, and each family will give up the potential to make a huge windfall, but they will pass on that public benefit to the next family. I want to stop there and not take up too much of your time, but I want to say that there's not really one size fits all in these policies. We haven't been able to identify the perfect inclusionary program that works everywhere. It really is a local policy, and it needs to be a local policy because the economics are different in every location. And so I think it's important that the state allow the jurisdictions where it makes sense to take advantage of this kind of policy. And if not this, how else will we make sure that there's room for lower and moderate income working families in our growing areas? Thank you, and I'd be really happy to answer additional questions if you would like to address them to me.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel?
Just real quick. It sure would be nice. You have this map, and I live in Gresham, and that's just outside of Portland, and we have taken the brunt of the degentrification, and so I doubt if my city would use inclusionary zoning, but it certainly would help for you to be able to have some affordable housing in Portland so we don't have that massive migration to the east side. But are these maps available, like, for my area, or did you just come up with
the Portland Housing Bureau produced this map
for
and
you.
And the data. I mean, I can check. We might have data for, you know, the Rockwood area and perhaps other portions of Gresham.
Yeah.
I'll check and get back to you.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Senator Dembrough.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Commissioner Salzman, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
So, you know, you've talked to us about the needs in Portland, and we have testimony that was submitted from the mayors of Eugene and Corvallis. But how widespread a problem do you see this as being? I mean, I think sometimes this is characterized as a Portland problem. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you think about some of your colleagues around the state, how important would be the lifting of the preemption for them?
Well, I should take this opportunity to say that, you know, I serve on the League of Oregon Cities board, and the League of Oregon Cities endorses this legislation, H-2564. So I think it is of the 242-some cities, you know, probably not every city. You know, Gresham, other cities are not facing the issue, but I think you look at a Corvallis, a Eugene, university towns, student housing impacts on people who work for the universities. It's not surprising that they also join, and I believe also Wilsonville is supporting this, and certainly members of the Washington County Commission. I'm not sure the county itself has a position, but I believe Multnomah County is also on board. So I think it's something that enjoys widespread support. Again, we're only asking for the ability to tailor a solution to what we think meets the issues in our particular situation, and every city is going to be a little different probably.
Senator Olson.
Commissioner Salzman, what's the average lot price in Portland? Do you know?
I don't know.
Okay. Sir, we talked earlier.
Follow-up? Or new question?
New question. Yeah. On the schematic or the drawing you put up on there, you said that the lady purchased a house for $250,000, but they were normally selling for $597,000. Was that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Olson. Yes, that was the average price in the city at the time.
And for that residential subdivision or residential neighborhood, or was this a developer that did those?
The $600,000 was the median price for the whole city of Santa Rosa. In her development, the price was slightly lower than that. They were $500,000 homes.
They were $500,000 homes.
Yeah.
And she was able to buy that at $250,000. Sorry, follow-up.
Follow-up.
Pardon me. That's why this takes so long. We have to do all these follow-ups. Can you imagine the court of law follow-up?
Exactly.
So anyhow, $500,000 in that particular subdivision in that development, and she got it for $250,000. What kind of benefits did the developer get from the city? Did he get the reduction of SDCs or anything like that?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I'm not familiar with the specific incentives that were offered in Santa Rosa. I did a survey of the entire state of California, and the vast majority of the 175 inclusionary housing programs offer fee reductions, expedited permitting, and density bonuses. And the density bonuses are by far the most valuable incentive. And Santa Rosa, I believe, offers an incentive to developers in the form of they could build more units on the site if they offered, or as a result of offering, the affordable housing like the house that Linda bought. And so I doubt, and I'm not positive of this, but I doubt that in the case of Santa Rosa, those incentives fully offset the cost to the developer, but they are likely to have offset a large share of the cost that the developer faced.
Follow-up, I'd like to question your argument that as these projects are developed, the increase in the profitability, how they just don't go up that fast. Trust me, I'm in the industry. They don't climb that fast when you're doing a project. The price is set when they go in and build them, and occasionally they do climb, but
yes,
our market is pretty stagnant.
Follow up?
Commissioner Salzman, what are the system development charges in Portland?
Well, we have a park system development charge, sewer, water, and transportation. I can't tell you what they are. I can tell you that most people regard them as high, and they value, Senator Olson, they value very much the waiver that we provide for affordable projects. That's probably one of the most sought-after incentives that we offer.
Follow up. I appreciate that, because in my city, which is Canby, my system development charges are $27,000.
Right.
Everybody asks me why I can't build affordable housing, because the lots cost $150,000. Mm-hmm. $27,000 for the system development charges. I'm $177,000 before I ever stick a shovel in the ground.
Right.
So the next question, follow up. When you say you expedite the process, the permit process, does that put that developer ahead of other people that are trying to get their projects in through the system?
Mr. Jacobus mentioned that as something that other cities do. We do not actually do expedited permit process, because it becomes a fairness issue. And
there
you probably know exactly.
Appreciate that. Thank you very much.
All right. And no further questions.
No.
Anybody else? No? Thank you so much. And I know you traveled a long way to be here with us today. I really appreciate it.
Very useful.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Very
much.
I
appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Our next panel is Diane Lynn, Councillor Barb Campbell, and Chris Fick. Good afternoon, Chair Gisler and the members of the committee. Thank you so much for this opportunity to address you today. My name is Diane Lynn. I'm Executive Director of Proud Ground. We're a nonprofit providing permanent affordable homeownership opportunities for working families, another variation on the theme that you just heard that holds properties in permanent affordability for, again, working families, not just for the first purchase, but well into the future. Our service area is the full metro area, and we're working in Lincoln County right now with the group there. I'm also the former Multnomah County Chair and Commissioner, and served in local government for over 14 years. I'm proudly working with a very broad coalition of stakeholders, including a list of groups I want to share with you very quickly. As you've heard from Commissioner Saltzman, the City of Portland, you're going to hear from the wonderful Mayor Katie Piercy from the City of Eugene a little bit later, Corvallis, Wilsonville, Milwaukee, the City of Hood River, Multnomah County, to be sure, Lincoln County, and the Metro Council. Certainly the elected officials from those jurisdictions, John Russell, a progressive developer from Portland, Russ Demerol, and members of the City Council specifically have weighed in and support as individuals. And we have a leader from the Coalition of Communities of Color, and Ben resident. Of course, you've heard, I'm sure, that Speaker of the House, Tina Kotek, has really been the champion for this effort. Advocacy groups, SEIU, AFSCME, the Oregon Housing Alliance, League of Oregon Cities, Association of Oregon Counties is also on board in support, League of Women Voters, Proud Ground, Elders in Action, AARP, American Planning Association of Oregon, Thousand Friends of Oregon, Oregon Opportunity Network, and the Oregon Environmental Councils and Working Families Party, among many others. All of these groups consist of literally tens of thousands of Oregonians across the state, including many residents in homes that are struggling to afford their housing. And remember, 60% of the jobs created in Oregon this last year are at 60% of median income. And as you've already heard, inclusionary housing is one of the best tools to meet this workforce housing issue. In reference to questions already asked, the affordability crisis is not just in Portland and Multnomah County. It's in the cities that you've already heard are in support of that have joined the largest jurisdictions in Oregon to repeal the ban on IZ. And part of this is because it's important to point out that they each have different housing markets and different policy needs, and that's why IZ is such an effective tool. It can be customized and adapted. And as Commissioner Saltzman already mentioned, and Senator Monis Anderson, this is important in your case, is this is really a regional issue. What happens in one jurisdiction really affects the other jurisdictions and the movement of people trying to find affordable housing along the way. So it is a real regional challenge. We support this bill that repeals ORS 197.309. We understand the -4 amendments that were approved by the City Council effectively replace a blanket prohibition with a conventional one. But we understand this, and we're also looking forward to avoiding any really additional conditions on the prohibition, if possible, with inclusionary zoning, because it limits local jurisdictions from benefiting from the breadth of the policy tool. The whole point is to have local jurisdictions that know their housing market best have the authority to apply these policies accordingly. You've already heard from the expert from Cornerstone Partnerships. There is 40 years of research effectively tested by 500 other jurisdictions nationwide that call to the best practices as it relates to inclusionary housing. And remember, I will point out that Oregon is only one of two states in the entire union that they have a statewide ban, and that's Oregon and Texas. And while it's a wonderful state, it's not, I don't think, the company we want in this kind of progressive environment. We want to reemphasize that the cost borne by inclusionary zoning, as you just heard, is by the land owners, not by the developers, not by the builders, and not by market rate homeowners or renters. The research calls this out. We want it to be fair and thoughtful, and we're very much looking forward to allowing for the creativity and the partnership that will be possible at the local level to not only apply these and bring more units on board with this tool, but we're also really looking forward to making sure that subsidy stays with those houses and make sure that they serve working families well into the future. And we already have those tools available to us. We're anxious to see this bill move forward. We really appreciate your leadership, Chair, and welcome the progress and conversation on this going forward. Time is of the essence. This is not the kind of measure that can be delayed. The market is going up, as you well know, every single day of the week, and we need action on this for working families this session. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you.
And just before people get started, I'm going to ask folks to be a little bit more concise, because there's a lot of folks that came. We want to get through everybody.
Of course.
Thanks.
Thank you, Chair Gelser, and thank you, Vice Chair Olson, who's out of the room. Mm-hmm. Thank you all for the time. My name is Barb Campbell. I live in Bend, Oregon. I was elected to our city council last fall, and I will tell you the truth. The learning curve for new sitting councilor is pretty steep, and I honestly wouldn't be taking my time to come over here to tell you how to do your job when I'm just trying to learn my own. But we need help. We really need help over in Bend. The first thing I'll tell you is that our vacancy rate for rentals is at 0.3%, which means on any given day, someone who wants to rent a home in Bend is going to have somewhere between 10 and 20 places to look at. That might be a studio apartment, that might be a five-bedroom home. Now, I understand that this bill is only dealing with single-family new construction, but a vacancy rate of 0.3 means that we have a whole lot of people in our town who are stuck where they don't want to be. They're in a studio apartment, they'd rather be in a two-bedroom. They're in a two-bedroom, they want a starter home. They're in a great big home, they want a retirement home, and we have none of those projects to offer to people. Where we're particularly strapped is in affordable housing. We simply, our costs have gone through the roof. I want to let you know that we're not, you know, just coming over here saying, oh, help us, help us. We've tried nothing and we don't know what to do next. We've tried a whole, you know, just in my 4 months, we have done the density bonuses. We've changed our cottage code. We've made some amendments to our accessory dwelling units. We're doing breaks on STCs in cooperation with our own parks department, and we've changed our codes addressing that problem we have with vacation rentals, with homes being turned into vacation rentals. And honestly, we need more help. We see this as another tool that we might be able to use. And quite honestly, I was just thinking about this, and I thought, really what I'm asking you is this just moves the fight. Believe me, the building representatives and they're going to be fighting with me in Bend, Oregon, for what is appropriate for Bend. And it occurred to me what I'm really doing here is asking you to make your life easier and my life harder. If you pass this, it moves to me, and then I can be the one trying for inclusionary zone in our town. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. Chris.
Chair Gelser, other members of the committee. Chris Fick with Multnomah County again for the record. We want to voice our support for the underlying bill and the Dash 5 amendments that the City of Portland has brought forward. Despite an unprecedented boom in multifamily housing units throughout our county, we still face a shortage of affordable units. Rising rents and a lack of affordable units has meant that working-class families, particularly families of color and low-income families, have been increasingly concentrated in East County, in Gresham in particular, as Senator Montes Anderson pointed out. Without the ability to encourage mixed-income housing for all neighborhoods, low-income families are increasingly segregated and forced to live in areas that have poor access to transportation, employment, parks, grocery stores, and other amenities. As a local government that provides services for the elderly, disabled, and low-income families, we understand how difficult it is to find housing for our clients. As aging and disability staff struggle to move clients out of nursing homes because they cannot find affordable and accessible housing units in the neighborhoods where these seniors want to live. More than half of all households that do find housing are rent-burdened, meaning they pay more than 30% of their incomes on rent alone. Families of color are rent burdened at an even higher rate. 57% of those households pay more than 30% of their incomes on rent and therefore cannot meet the needs of their families and are at risk of becoming homeless. Public subsidies and voluntary incentives alone cannot overcome the shortage we're facing in Multnomah County. We need the private sector to partner in our community efforts to develop solutions for the affordable housing crisis. And it's not just a problem in Multnomah County. We've heard from folks in Central Oregon, along the coast, and in rural areas throughout our state. Including rental property in this bill, as the Dash 5 amendments would, is essential if it's going to make a dent in our county. With the state's largest city largely landlocked, its future growth is dependent on multifamily units, many of which will be offered for rent only. Moreover, since many lower-income residents are not in a position to purchase a home, this bill, as it's currently written, will be of little, if perhaps no assistance. Inclusionary zoning is a practical, flexible tool that has been used in urban, suburban, and rural communities throughout the country. The time has come for the Oregon Legislature to allow communities in our state the ability to craft local solutions through all the available planning tools, including inclusionary zoning. Ms. Lynn mentioned in her testimony it's a tool that's been around for 40 years, and over 500 jurisdictions are currently making use of it. We think we should have this tool as well. Thank you.
Thank you all very much. Are there any questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you very much. Next up, we have Sean Julians and John Chandler. And you two are not subject to the new 3-minute rule.
No.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here in opposition to House Bill 2564. This was a study, the subject of a great deal of conversation over on the House side. As you know, and I'll refer you to the House testimony that we submitted and the floor letter we put in and saw on OLIS. Just a couple questions real quickly before I tell you from our perspective where this issue stands right now. We agree there's an affordability problem in the state. I don't think anybody looking at markets in Portland, the metro area generally, Bend, other places, would say there isn't an affordability problem. Where we disagree with the thrust of House Bill 2564 is we quite simply don't believe that that builders or people who purchase new homes have some unique responsibility to fix that problem. It's a societal issue. It's not ours to fix. It wasn't ours to create. It's something all of us should be working on. We may have a role there, and we can talk about that here in a moment with some of the ideas we've suggested, but we certainly don't have a unique responsibility to take a loss or to make less money or to otherwise contort our business in order to address this issue. We also believe that local governments have the tools available that they need right now. Inclusionary zoning is not prohibited in Oregon under current law. Mandatory inclusionary zoning is. They can be done on a voluntary basis by offering the same sorts of incentives that a mandatory program would have to include in order for it to be workable. That could be done now, and that's something in a lot of jurisdictions. My members, builders around Oregon, are actually working with the local governments to make housing affordable. Frankly, one of the things that's most frustrating about this issue is you're intersecting the real estate market at the tail end, at the demand side. You can't get serious about affordable housing, and I believe we need to, not just your committee, but this legislature as a state, we need to get serious about affordable housing. That's going to need to talk about the land use system. It's going to need to talk about our tax system. We're going to have to talk about infrastructure finance. We're going to have to talk about the permitting process. We're going to have to talk about all those things that go into the cost of land, the cost of development, the reason we have an affordability issue. Most of those that I just rattled off are, of course, politically very tendentious and are oftentimes off limits in this building. That doesn't mean they're not important. You can't take lots in Portland, to Senator Olson's question, that are somewhere between $80,000 and $300,000, depending on what neighborhood and what sort of house development is going to be done, and with impact fees and SDCs that are upwards of $35,000. So even at the low end, and I just talked to one, I sent a text to one of my builder members who builds in the city of Portland, does starter homes. He says he's into every project $135,000 round numbers before he puts a stick down. It's very difficult to do affordable housing under those circumstances. So if we want to talk about how to drive that cost curve down, you have to look at ways to stop those inputs from being so high and not just start at that tail end. With that said, when we oppose this bill in the House, and we do not support the base bill, we made it very clear to Speaker Kotek, Chair Kenny Geyer, and the House through a floor letter that we do not support the engrossed version, but we were willing and open to having further conversations on the topic. I didn't see the dash 5 amendments until today. We don't think much of them either, and if you do decide to work those, Madam Chair, we'd like the ability to speak to those specifically. But with regard to the A engrossed version of the bill, and in keeping with the commitment I made to the Speaker to try to continue working, we have put some ideas down on paper. We've sent I believe some of you have seen it. We sent it to the Speaker and others. It's not in the form of an amendment because it's a conversation. But it kind of goes into three broad categories, I'll be very quick, of things that we believe for this type of program, which doesn't exist in a systemic fashion in Oregon now. You need to look at the thresholds. The bill in front of you says a 30% threshold, that 30% of the units can be required to be affordable. We think that's far too high. Even if the offsets were completely designed to completely compensate the builder-developer for their costs, it's still a very risky business, subject to all sorts of fluctuations. A much lower percentage is what's used in other parts of the country in those 500 programs you've heard about. We would be much more comfortable with something in the 10 to 15% range. I think there also needs to be some kind of a floor. Right now, the way this bill is written, a triplex, one of those units can be made to require affordability. And again, if it's completely offset, that may or may not make much of a difference. If there's any contribution by the builder or the developer, you have to have a broader range of units over which to amortize that cost. Most developments outside of Oregon are much larger because of our land use system. We don't have large developments like they have in California, like they have in Maryland, like they have in Virginia. Our average subdivision, last time I looked at the numbers, was about 25 lots. It's really difficult to absorb much of a lot on one or two units even across 25 lots. If you're doing 2,500 lots, it's a different conversation. It's still bad policy, but at least it isn't financially damaging to the builder and the developer. I think we should look at what categories inclusionary zoning could be applied to in terms of whether we're talking about high-rise development like Commissioner Saltzman was talking about. There may be a conversation, particularly for the city of Portland, perhaps over 4 stories in height or something like that. But we need to be real clear about what we're talking about and also perhaps some size limitations. As one of your witnesses talked about, for these programs to be successful long-term, there has to be a program in place to monitor, to make sure they don't get game, to make sure there's some kind of an equity share so you don't go backwards. That's going to be beyond the scope of most smaller jurisdictions. The larger ones might be able to pull that off. And I think we may need to talk about where the need exists, either by reference to median income. This isn't just this is a dramatic intervention of government in a real estate market. Those should be done very cautiously, if at all, and at least require, I think, some showing that there is an affordability problem and not just something that they heard about at a conference. As far as developer incentives are concerned, the list in front of you in that bill, there's an itemized list of things that cities would have to do in order for inclusionary zoning to work. That's a list that we actually developed in the House conversation. But the context of that is very important. We developed that list to be examples for cities in the context of a voluntary inclusionary zoning program, not as sideboards for a mandatory program. For example, one of the things on that list is that lowered costs have to be part of it. There's no definition of what that means. I don't believe any of us would say that a $10 decrease in a building permit ought to then somehow require inclusionary zoning. And if the intention is to have this program be offset, be fair to the developer and builder, make us partners, and to use basically the hydraulics of the existing development process in order to get more affordable housing, that may be worth talking about. But if that's the case, then there has to be some equalization, some proportionality for, I believe, to be legal constitutionally, but even beyond that, to make it fair to the builder-developer so that we're not, again, being asked to carry a disproportionate burden. And I think it's some clear statement that that proportionality is the objective would be something we would be looking for. One of the ideas, and these are just ideas, I don't want to be told that we committed to anything. These are intended to start a conversation. There's already a law in the books for expedited land divisions. It's a 63-day turnaround. There's no local hearing and a very limited and very quick review. There's actually a bill going through another committee on this very topic. Perhaps we could say that anything with inclusionary zoning gets that expedited treatment so that there's no – that's a huge saving for the developer, is to be able to move things through quickly. You could eliminate one category of SDCs, system development charges. The one I would suggest is parks. Parks SDCs are almost always the largest number in a jurisdiction. They're also, they tend to go up the fastest and be the most difficult to quantify. And there's no way to declare a development moratorium for lack of parks. This is not to say we don't like parks and appreciate parks and think they're important, but if you're looking for ways to save money, that's probably a better place to give than water, sewer, transportation. I think we could look at some kind of a other forms of infrastructure financing, which again gets into some very complicated issues. But the biggest number for a lot of developments is that infrastructure number that you have to pay in order to get necessary services. So those are the kind of incentives we'd be looking at, in addition to the normal run-of-the-mill sorts of fee decreases, to get back to that proportionality. And the final point I want to make, Madam Chair and members, is with regard to the system requirements, I think we'd want to be real clear what we're trying to do with inclusionary zoning. Because right now I've heard all sorts of arguments for it. We're not sure if we're targeting working-class housing, people making between, let's say, 80 and 120% of median, or if we're trying to get below 80% into some of the more traditionally low-income housing types of purchasers. That may be fine, but a different the program would, I think, have to be tailored to make clear about what we're doing. The other thing I've heard is trying to get a mixture within a community of communities, ethnicities, income segments, and so on. That gets much fancier than simply trying to set a sales target price. So I think some clarity about what it is we're trying to accomplish would be very helpful. Probably the most important point I want to leave you with is if this bill moves forward, which we hope it doesn't without some of these amendments being discussed and included, We would suggest very strongly that it be applied at the comprehensive planning stage, not at with property that's already, where land has already been purchased, plans have already been developed, and then the developer or builder finds out that they have to figure out some way to sell houses for less money. If you put it at the planning stage so that going in you know that this requirement's on the book, similar to an impact fee or anything else, you can adjust your price, you can adjust your financial models, you can adjust your business plan. If you do it midstream, where I'm in the phase two of a five-phase project and have to figure out how to amortize on the back end, that's going to be extraordinarily unfair. And frankly, not necessarily that you should bleed from my membership. It'll probably result in projects not being built. And in a state where you already have a housing problem, that having projects not go forward is probably not the right answer. And finally, I think it'd be very important. Some cities have done a pretty decent job of putting their own skin in the game on these issues. Others have not. I think if you're going to look to the private sector, someone mentioned a partnership with the private sector. We're all for partnerships. Partnerships imply at least two parties. We would want to see some ability on the local side as well to put city money in, whether it be some kind of new funding source, whether it be a land trust, or some tool on their end, recognizing that they're not just trying to turf this issue off to the private sector to have us fix it. These are incredibly important issues. They are incredibly important for our communities. We want to be part of the solution. We've never not wanted to. The only reason the law is on the books in the first place is because we feared and still do it being used for nefarious purposes and to stop growth altogether rather than to get growth in an affordable fashion. I think some sideboards, some discussion, we might be able to get to a bill that we could agree to. The bill in front of you is not that. With that, Madam Chair, members, I'll conclude and be glad to take any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillian, today representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. We are also in opposition to House Bill 2564 and the Dash 5 Amendment as well, Madam Chair. I think, as Mr. Chandler mentioned, we definitely support the underlying goals of this bill. Everyone in this room supports more affordable housing being built in Oregon, driving down the cost factors that potentially get to that. And we've done previous examples via the legislative process to do that. I looked up the most recent numbers on a bill that both of us and many of the folks in this room supported from 2009 that increased the document recording fee that has generated $58 million for affordable housing projects since its inception. And that was a very different process. We met for several years, the advocates from both sides. We had the bankers, home builders, realtors all in a room with affordable housing developers and other groups. And it was a long and painful process, but ultimately we came to a consensus and were able to bring a package to you all that we all agreed to and could go forward. And we helped shepherd through the legislative process. And we actually even had signed agreements that we would all be on board for certain things and not others. I think we all participated this past time in a legislative work group where this is one of the items that we didn't have consensus on, and lo and behold, it's the sort of shining object that we're coming forward in this legislative session. I have to say, for those of us who have spent most of the interim in the work group, it's a little disappointing that the item that we couldn't come to consensus on is the thing that seems to have taken up most of the time in the legislative session on it. You hear a lot, and we have certainly heard about how Oregon is one of only two states that has this preemption on it. Well, Oregon is also the only state that has our land use system. And our land use system preempts a lot of things at the local level and centralizes a lot of control in the state government. It produces a high quality of life, and so there are trade-offs, though, with that land use system. Artificially constraining the supply of land is going to drive up the cost. And I think Oregonians are strongly supportive of the land use system, as you've seen time and time again at the ballot, but it comes with its pitfalls, and that is an affordability issue. No better example of that than the previous testimony about the city of Bend, who spent significant amounts of money trying to expand their urban growth boundary over a number of years and still hasn't been able to achieve that. Obviously, providing more land is not going to be the silver bullet that solves all problems in Bend, but it would certainly help alleviate the sort of buildup that they've had there as they've seen exponential growth and they haven't had the ability to expand out their urban growth boundary. With all due respect to the expert testimony at the beginning about not driving up the market rate units, we have significant concerns that that's exactly what it will do. You see examples from other states. Well, you don't see examples from other states with our land use system where you're artificially constraining the supply of land and availability of land for development. There are only so many new units that are being built in Oregon. As Mr. Chandler mentioned, they're on a much smaller scale than many other states are. As we've testified on this bill over the years, I always bore the committee with testimony on when I worked for the city of Henderson in Nevada, which at the time was the fastest growing municipality in the country. And we actually were talking about some sort of incentive-based inclusionary zoning programs, and it would be on a 13,000-unit master plan community. It's a little easier to spread out the costs on a 13,000-unit master plan community instead of one of Mr. Chandler's typical subdivisions, which is 25 units, especially with the current threshold in the bill of 30%. So basically, you're looking at 8 of the houses have to be below market rate. It's really hard to adjust that going forward. We are, as Mr. Chandler committed to as well, committed to working on the bill and on further amendments. We signed on to the floor letter on the House as well, saying we oppose the bill as it's currently drafted, but we are willing to come over here and work on additional amendments to see if we could get somewhere where we could get to neutral on the bill. I stand by that as far as our commitment as the real estate industry. With that, Madam Chair, I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel? Senator Dimbrough.
Thanks, Madam Chair. You know, I would be just as happy if this bill would simply lift the preemption on inclusionary zoning. You know, we heard that this is a tool that's available to cities all around the country. You know, as you said, 48 other states have this tool. And, you know, the question is, why are we depriving Oregon local governments from having this tool and being able to craft things that work for them? And, you know, I know that in Sean, I can see that one factor in our rising land costs, you know, could be related to our land use planning, but our land use system, but we see rising land costs all over the country and in many different markets that don't have our land use system. So to say that, you know, they can have it because they don't have land use planning, our cities can't have it, you know, that just doesn't really make sense to me. And so I guess I'm just wondering what problems you predict, you know, either of you can answer this, you know, if this authority is vested in the hands of the local governments, you know, how are they not capable of addressing the needs in their communities?
Well, Senator Denbrough, Madam Chair, Senator Denbrough, I'd start with happily helping you draft up an amendment that gave locals jurisdiction over their land use system as well, and we'd probably go along with inclusionary zoning right with it. Now, Mr. Chandler might not go there, but I think we would certainly do that. I'm not trying to imply that that's the only cost driver on our system. I'm just saying that it's something that does exacerbate our problem. So I think when we have centralized land use planning, our concern is the unintended consequences of this. We truly have the fear that this is going to drive up the cost of the other very limited market rate units that are coming on the market right now in single family residential, to be honest with you. You have a system that's sort of driving through decisions recently, more and more multifamily, saying that we're going to adopt more policies to do more multifamily development, and that's all going to go in there. You're going to have even less single family residential developed. And so representing realtor side of things, where we rely on a healthy real estate market of people actually purchasing homes, that's a very significant concern for us.
If I might, Madam Chair, Senator Denbrough, I would take you up on that offer if we wanted to. I don't think it fits within the relating clause, but it's a dandy idea. One of the other implications of our land use system isn't simply supply of land, although that's huge. It's what it does to our industry. If you look at almost every other area of this size with this level of population growth in the country, you have the national builders. We don't have national builders here. We have a handful of them, outgrowths of the big companies. And they're not here because they don't understand our land use system and don't want to put up with it. What that means then is you have merchant builders in Oregon for the most part. Our largest builder back in the heyday was several hundred units a year, which is barely a division of one of the national outfits. And it goes to that economy of scale again of what you've got a bunch of small businesses doing 5, 10, 25 homes a year. That's our concern. If you turn this open to the cities and said, here, do what you want to do, if a city did it, that's going to be very damaging and didn't do it right without some sideboards, without some protections. They would expose the developers in that community because they're not one of the the nationally traded companies to a great deal of financial risk. That'd be unacceptable. The other concern we have with that, and the reason the bill was brought forward initially in the 90s, was not every jurisdiction, I mean, no disrespect to my friends in local government, but not every jurisdiction is going to approach this with a sincere attempt to get a low-income housing in their community. We were very fearful then, and we're fearful now, that a community would look at this, adopt an inclusionary zoning ordinance, was extraordinarily rigorous, no direction from the state about what it had to look like, and say you had to have half the units affordable, let's say. And the builder would look at that and say, well, we can't build there. And nothing would happen. No housing would be built, which is what the community wanted in the first place, and life would go forward. And it's important background noise for this committee, and this is because you haven't been dealing with these issues this session, now you haven't heard this. We should be building in Oregon, and this is the state economist's numbers, not mine, to just keep up with births over deaths, family formation, in-migration, we should be doing around 23 to 25, depending on how you cut the numbers, 1,000 units a year. That's not a boom market. That's not the Yahoo days. That's just keeping up with demand. We may do 14 or 15,000 this year. So we are our housing market here is not robust. The prices are high. The development side of it, the building side of it, the new construction side of it is still lagging badly. We're at barely over half, maybe close to two-thirds. We're very nervous, Senator, about anything that messes with that, especially right now, because we're not back on our feet yet after the recession. Long answer to a short question. I think that the state, and to use the land use metaphor a little bit further, we tinker with all sorts of things at the state level, calling them issues of state concern. And we get involved in things that other states don't with our local governments. I think the same exact argument can be made with regard to affordable housing. It is an issue of state concern. It doesn't just deserve the state to tell the locals, good luck, do the best you can, see you later. We don't do that on other very important issues to the state, whether it be taxation policy, liquor regulation, you name it, marijuana regulation, if and when we ever get around to that. I don't know why we would simply do a free pass to the local governments on something as important as affordable housing.
I have more questions, but I'll take them offline.
Okay. Just real quick.
Senator Olson was next, Senator Mona Sanderson.
That's Senator Mona Sanderson.
In my area, we have a lot of refugees, and they tend to want to live in the same area. We have a lot of Latinos. They tend to live in the same area, same areas. I don't know enough about inclusionary zoning on how it would affect those populations that really want to live next to their culture, so to speak. Does that have any impact? Maybe other people can come up. You probably don't have the answers to that, you guys do.
Madam Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson, I'm going to duck, if you don't mind.
All right.
Probably the next panel.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Thank you. And Mr. Chandler, I'd like to point out that since I know this industry, one of the things that I found as far as affordable housing is the general cost of new construction. This body has added so much cost to building a new home, it's unbelievable. 50% efficient lighting, thicker walls, thicker insulation, this, that, the seismic tie downs, and all the things. It's added considerably in the last 10 years, which when I first moved out here, we were building T111 on 2x4 walls. You could build a cheap home at that time. And by cheap, I don't mean cheap, I mean inexpensive. This body, have added tremendously to the cost. Secondly, when you draw a circle around the city and you say you must have 20 years buildable land in there, and someone comes in and develops four or five lots, well, that 20 years is gone, so somebody wants to annex into the city. What's the problem? They have to pay for the annexation to get into the city and hope that the voters will allow them to come in. And if they don't allow them to come in, that's a $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 cost for just the voting, and your land's not even in yet. So we have added a lot of cost to the process, which precludes us from building lesser value homes or cheap, inexpensive housing for people. Like I said, in the community that I build in, $178,000 just sticking the shovel into the ground. The other thing we didn't mention was the fact that we now have a charge that this body put on us, $1 a square foot for schools. It doesn't seem to be a lot, but it's $1,500 on a 1,500 square foot house. All those things add up.
And Senator Olson, do you have a question in there?
I do have a question in there. I do have. Right. What I'm trying to do is explain why things are not as they all so look. Mr. Chandler, if someone was to come in and without our land use laws, without our zoning requirements, to come in, What would you think his cost would be if he was to be able to plop a 5-acre subdivision right outside of a city like Canby?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, since 5 acres right outside of the city of Canby is getting close to where I live, I'm not sure I'm going to be much of a NIMBY on you. I'm going to hedge a little bit. It would be less money than we're paying now, and part of that. And again, I'm not arguing the land use system is flawed inherently. I think that we need to take it into account, like Mr. Gillian said. In fact, some years ago, we did a study along with 1,000 Friends and others, probably 20 years ago now, spent $50,000, which is a lot of money that we didn't really have, and we found for our $50,000, but we were trying to study the effect of the urban growth boundary on land prices, and we found that for our $50,000, what we really needed was about a $500,000 study. So it was a good investment to find out that we were asking the wrong question, too little money. There's clearly an effect. If you didn't have the UGBs, you simply had to deal with water and sewer and that sort of thing, land prices would be lower. Is that going to happen in Oregon? No, it's not. My point, though, and I think the point Senator Olson was making, is you can't look at the real estate market as being monolithic. It is a function of a great many decisions. We do have one of the most rigorous building codes in the country and one of the most temperate climate zones. You could dial our building code back tremendously on energy, for example, and lower costs equally dramatically. Not sure that's going to happen, but that's one of the inputs that this body and its body's delegates through the Building Codes Division and Department of Energy have done. Transportation requirements, on and on and on, all of which are perfectly valid and wonderfully accepted. They're fine in and of themselves, but if you start looking through an affordability metric, that's what I guess in a sense what my point was trying to be. You can't just intersect and say, wow, those houses are expensive, let's sell them for cheaper. You have to look at why are those houses expensive and get serious again about making those tough decisions in order to drive the costs down. land use, tax policy, infrastructure policy. And I should mention, too, just before the cities yell at me, we helped write the SDC law, the System Development Charge Law, in 1989. That was us and the local governments. We believe in paying our freight in terms of going forward costs of infrastructure. The cities have no choice because we haven't talked about Measure 5 and Measure 50, which are topics that routinely come up in some committee that sits that away and then disappear immediately because they're very hard. But we're never going to get our hands around how much it costs to hook up to water and sewer until we do something about the property tax system. Those are all the sorts of things that in a functional, if we're really going to get at this issue, it isn't inclusionary zoning, it isn't rent control, like the Dash 5s would indicate. It's got to be more holistic. That's our biggest concern. We would love to be part of that holistic conversation.
I got to ask one for Sean Jillians.
Really, we've got 10 more people in 15 minutes.
Really short. Sean, you've probably been involved in many developments. Many times a developer goes in, lays out the streets, and puts it the way he wants it. The city council comes in, and what do? They make major changes. They move the streets around. They require wider streets, wider sidewalks, and now we also require our drainage ditches and all of those things that they now add to the cost. Doesn't this affect the way the developer can come in and manage his market and control his costs on his properties?
Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, I think it's hard to tell because we don't know exactly what the program would look like and what the requirements would be. And it goes to Senator Dembrough's question originally of why not just repeal it altogether. I think I would ask the question back, Senator Dembrough, why not go forward with a more limited approach and see if this actually works? Because for 20-plus years, we've allowed voluntary and no one's really taken us up on the offer on it. Now we're going to potentially allow mandatory with sideboards that maybe we could live with and see if that solves the problem. If it doesn't, then I'm sure there'll be bills introduced to broaden it out a little bit. But it's a big step to just go from outright preemption to free-for-all. And we are concerned about the unintended consequences that could be there and actually have the opposite effect of what the desire is of everyone in the room.
Thank you. And with that, we're going to move on to the next panel. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. We've got Mayor Kitty Piercy, Christina Narayan, Maggie Talmadge. Please. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Gelser, member of the committee. For the record, my name is Kitty Piercy. I'm the mayor of Eugene. Thank you for this opportunity to provide comments on House Bill 2564. Same story you've heard from others. Like other communities in Oregon, many residents of the city of Eugene face housing affordability issues, with over 50% of our residents being housing cost burdened, meaning the ratio of the cost of housing relative to income is disproportionate and unaffordable. We have aggressively identified and purchased housing sites, offered incentives such as tax exemptions, SCDC waivers, and permitting assistance, and directed federal and local funds towards increasing housing options for all Eugene residents, including our returning veterans. We think some of the things that Mr. Chandler brought up make some valuable sense around what should be discussed. Just discuss it at the local level. The city also provides low-interest loans for housing rehabilitation. We have made incremental gains in creating affordable housing options, but there continues to be a gap in the inventory available relative to the increasing need. As the affordable housing need increases, so does the need to continue building our toolbox of solutions. Inclusionary zoning is a tool that our council wants to consider adding to our existing toolbox in the future. The opportunity to do so should be a local matter, something to be discussed, debated, and ultimately decided by our city governance body, the Eugene City Council. It remains to be seen whether the City of Eugene would in fact adopt an inclusionary zoning ordinance if the statutory ban on inclusionary zoning is repealed as a result of this bill. But we'd like to see have that conversation. I'm currently serving on the HUD-required State Consolidated Plan for Housing. At the last meeting, we heard from consultants who looked at Oregon statutes related to affordable housing to identify barriers. They found our policies good, actually some of the best in the nation. They did, however, make one suggestion to help make more affordable housing available. They suggested we consider lifting the ban on inclusionary zoning. Our council is clear in its support of the preservation and expansion of programs and tools to fund the development of affordable housing for those with low incomes. Inclusionary zoning is one of those tools that we would like to be able to consider locally as a matter of home rule. We respectfully urge this committee to forward House Bill 2564 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Thanks so much for the time to talk to you.
Thank you very much, Mayor. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
Chair, Vice Chair, members of the committee, my name is Christina Narayan. I'm a policy associate with the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon, or APANO. Now, I would love to give some time to the rest of the folks who are waiting in line, so I will be brief and shy away from my prepared notes. I'm no expert. I feel very fortunate to be among such esteemed speakers today, but I would like to share a little story about myself. I've called Oregon home for nearly my entire life. I was born to immigrant parents from Yugoslavia and Fiji who chose the Westland-Wilsonville School District to raise their children because it was of par to their educational standards. Now, my mother valued education so much that when she became a single parent, she chose to stay in this district, and she did so at an incredible expense. She worked longer hours. She limited herself to one day off, just so that I could walk to school safely, that I could enjoy my summer spent at Memorial Skate Park. These are the sacrifices that parents have to make daily to provide their children with opportunities. Now, I am a proud product of that school district. I also attend Portland State University, where I am completing my undergraduate education. I'd like to think that my mother did okay. If she's, hi, Mom.
I'm so sorry.
Now, if I was born today and raised in Wilsonville, my mother would not be able to form the new developments that are spurting all across that city. And unfortunately, this is a reality that many face across the state. And it's not fair. And we heard Mr. Chandler say many things today. He also mentioned that it was not the developer's burden to ease the pains of in access to affordable housing. Now, he also mentioned that there needs to be a partnership. Now, if you have an apathetic party to a partnership, how then do you move forward other than implementing mandatory inclusionary zoning? So with that, I urge your support for HB 2564.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair, Vice Chair, and Committee on the Human Services and Early Childhood. My name is Margaret Talmadge. I'm the Environmental Justice Manager at the Coalition of Communities of Color. The Coalition seeks to address the socioeconomic disparities, institutional racism, and inequity of services experienced by our families, children, and communities, and to organize for collective action resulting in social change to obtain self-determination, wellness, justice, and prosperity. The Coalition is an alliance of 19 culturally specific community-based organizations representing six communities of color: African, African American, Asian and Pacific Islander, Latino, Native American, and Slavic. HB 2564 is a priority bill for the Coalition. We support repealing the ban on inclusionary zoning, one tool to help jurisdictions ensure equal housing opportunities for all families and communities. Oregon's continued prohibition of this well-established tool continues to foster a racial and economic divide, leaving behind communities of color and immigrants and refugees. While the economy has begun to recover since 2008, wage growth and economic benefits have not been felt economy-wide. Many renters and communities of color are not seeing these gains to the extent of white households. And as housing prices and rents rise, communities of color, low-income communities, seniors and single mothers are seeing their incomes and housing opportunities severely constrained. Households are increasingly pushed to the fringes of cities, communities are increasingly segregated, and widespread disparities are exacerbated. Homeownership rates within communities of color lag far behind white families, and the gap is increasing. As of 2010, the statewide gap between white homeownership and black homeownership is a staggering 98%. While the gap for Latino homeownership is 62%. The impacts of these disparities go far beyond wealth creation. Homeownership and housing stability also affect educational attainment, community and public health, access to jobs, transit, community centers, and healthy food, and overall quality of life. Our families and communities face disproportionate housing cost burdens, often spending 30% or even 50% of their income on housing. The recent State of Housing in Portland report reiterates this. Only white and married couples with children have median incomes high enough to withstand rising house costs in most parts of the town. Average black households can afford to rent in 7 of Portland's neighborhoods without becoming cost burden. Average Native American households can afford to rent in 2. The average black or Native American or extremely low-income three-person household can afford to buy a home in exactly 0 of Portland's neighborhoods without being cost burden. Communities of color are increasingly growing, and lifting the ban on IZ allows jurisdictions, should they choose, to promote housing mobility for these growing communities that have historically and are increasingly left behind. Lifting the ban provides a tool to address priorities tied so close to housing stability, reducing health disparities, closing an education gap, reducing income inequality, and supporting diverse, sustainable, and community-oriented neighborhoods. Help us repeal this ban on inclusionary zoning and support House Bill 2564.
Great. Thank you very much. And we're going to hold our questions just so we can try to get through some folks. Next, Allegra Briggs, Russell Dondero, and Mary McCurdy, please. And we still have another 4 folks after you, so if you could try to confine your comments to about 2 minutes, that would be really helpful, please.
Chair Gessler and Gelser, I'm sorry. My name is Russ Dondero. I am a retired political science professor and a housing advocate. I've been working on this issue for over 24 years in Washington County and here in this Capitol building. Chair Gelser and the committee, I'm going to shorten my comments because you have my testimony before you. And I just want to respond to some of the issues that have arisen in the previous testimony. Number one, I want to remind ourselves that among the most important causes of homelessness in Oregon and the United States is the lack of affordable housing. That's number one. I could go down the list, as was done recently on OPB and Tavis Smiley's interview of Susan Sarandon and her son. But that's the one point. That's the major point: lack of affordable housing and homelessness. Why do I say that? Because for over 20 years, I worked in Washington County on the Housing Advisory Committee from 1999 to 2008, and since then on the Housing and Homelessness Committee. And the problems in Washington County have not gotten better. They've gotten worse. Currently, right now in Washington County, we have a 19,000 housing gap between what we need to serve those people in need. And I'm talking about people in the 50 or more percent lower than median or area family income. So the population I'm concerned about mostly are people who are renters. That's why I support not only the bill, but also the -5 amendments. Because unless we are able to first stabilize people who are homeless and then get people into reasonable rental housing, only then can we move them into opportunities to be homeowners, which is the goal. By the way, it's a goal of the Housing Trust Fund, which I helped write in 1991 with a lot smarter people than me. And it's the goal in Washington County, which I did help write. And so we all agree, probably in this room, the ideal should be homeownership. But it's very hard to move people in the 50% and under into homeownership very easily. In fact, in Washington County...
And Mr. Dondero, I'm going to ask you to summarize
The key is to keep in mind what the problem is. It's homelessness, it's housing affordability, and as we address that issue, then we're going to make it and get to where we want to be. Otherwise, we won't.
Thank you so much. Welcome.
Hi.
Madam Chair, Chairwoman, and members of the committee. I'm a little new to this, so please excuse my nervousness. I am not...
Can you say your name for the record,
please? Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Allegra Briggs. I'm a resident of Bend. I'm not a public official. I'm not an expert, but I am someone who wants to own a home. As you know, housing is very difficult in Bend, and it's people not just at the low income, but at the middle income, too. Houses are being built all over Bend, but they're the luxury homes. They're at market rate, and they're not being built for people like me. I strongly feel that inclusionary housing would help the situation in my town, not just for low income, but people who are at the medium income as well. The ban to me seems very unjust. I encourage you to repeal the ban. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. My name is Mary Kyle McCurdy, Policy Director at 1000 Friends of Oregon. I want to bring us back to the point of the underlying bill, well, as amended 2564A. It's a tool that will be available to local governments to use or not in the way in which they want to, if they choose to use it, both the tools and the income levels to which it would apply, the length of time of the affordability, et cetera. All those details are, as the city council person from Bend said, a discussion to have, arguments to have at the local level, and to see whether and how it should be applied. Inclusionary housing is not the silver bullet for all affordable housing issues. It is not the only place in which this lift is being made. You've heard, so sometimes it's been portrayed as all of the burden of affordable housing being put only on this tool. This tool is useful, and it should be in the toolbox of local governments to choose to use or not, but it won't solve it all. You've heard cities who have done a lot of things to move down the road of meeting affordable housing, such as SDC waivers, density bonuses, those sorts of things. Not all cities can absorb the costs in that. Waiving an SDC doesn't mean the cost of the water or the sewer goes away. It means it's absorbed in some other way. But a inclusionary housing tool provides another tool in the toolbox for local governments that don't have all the resources of a Portland but might want to step up and do something more for affordable housing. It's not an experimental tool. As you've heard, it's been used by over 40 states over 30 years. There's a lot of experience in how to use this, and this tool has been used in states and in regions with stricter land use laws than we have in Oregon. This is something that, in fact, is very compatible, I believe, with our land use planning program, and it works well because of the predictability built into the land use planning program. This is an ideal tool for jurisdictions to use to get ahead of the displacement that can come with public investments, for example. I think that's why you see jurisdictions like Milwaukee or Hood River that are facing the potential displacement of housing due to a light rail line about to open in Milwaukee in September, or investments in the recreational amenities of places like Hood River, Bend, that sort of thing, that have now a lot of vacation rentals. This enables cities to get ahead of those kinds of potentially displacing public investments in order to let the existing community members and all members of the community benefit from those investments. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And colleagues, we've got one last panel of four people. Could people hang around for another 8 minutes?
Go for it.
Thank you very much. Joanne Harrigal, Stephen Kafori, Sarah Elabieri, and Ruth Adkins.
You all saved my time.
OK, thank you, Ruth. And did I hit everybody that signed up? Did I invite everybody? Sorry. Welcome.
Madam Chair and members of the panel, I'm going to keep my comments very brief. I'm with Elders in Action. My name is Joanne Harrigal. I'm the Civic Involvement Coordinator. We're a nonprofit in Portland that advocates for older adults, and we support the passage of HB 2564. And I'll share with you information that I did not, in fact, get when I was at a conference recently, which is 1 in 4 baby boomers nationally have no retirement savings and no children to support them. An individual that relies solely on Social Security income has a monthly income of $733. And if they pay 30% of their income for housing, that leaves them $220 a month for either rent or a mortgage. It's not really doable. We urge you to pass this bill, and we also support the Dash 5 amendments for rentals. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Kufori. I'm here today representing the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association. This is land use planners in the state of Oregon. The way our land use planning system works, as you know, is that we have statewide goals and then and guidelines, and those are to be interpreted and implemented by local government. And I think this bill fits exactly into that plan. Goal 10, if I may just briefly read it, buildable lands for residential use shall be inventoried and plans shall encourage the availability of adequate numbers of needed housing units at price ranges and rent levels which are commensurate with the financial capacities of Oregon households and allow for flexibility of housing location type and density. And just briefly, in order to accomplish that, we need to have as many tools locally as we can. Inclusionary zoning is one of those tools. It's not the answer to everything, but it's one. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Vice Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Elabieri, and I'm here on behalf of the Urban League in Portland in support of House Bill 2564 and the Dash 5 amendments. The Urban League recently participated in several overflow meetings on housing issues in North and Northeast Portland, and the lack of affordable housing was one of the most prominent issues. We're committed to being an active supporter of House Bill 2564 and the Dash 5 amendments because the low-income residents and communities of color affected under the current statute have been severely impacted by the adverse effects of urban renewal, housing displacement, racism, classism, and gentrification. Many people, family, and friends in the African American and other communities of color are being priced out of their homes and out of their traditional neighborhoods, school districts, places of worship, and jobs close to their homes. Inclusionary zoning, while not the be-all, end-all solution for displacement, however, does give cities a critical tool to combat economic and racial segregation, gentrification, and displacement. Passing this bill will make a positive difference for healthy families and productive communities to become more successful members of the community and to at least feel included. As more families are scrambling to find secure affordable housing, it is clear that inclusionary zoning could help keep low-income residents and communities of color to stay in close-in neighborhoods, reduce transportation and housing costs, and have more money to boost their local economy with the purchase of essentials like healthy food, clothes, health care, and recreation. It gives low-income residents and communities of color greater choices about living in areas with better-paying jobs, good schools, healthier environments with clean air, safe parks, and religious and community centers. As you heard from the testimony earlier, inclusionary zoning is working in many communities across the country and have resulted in positive results by creating more diverse communities and generating funds for low-income housing. As you know, and we've heard many times, only Texas and Oregon currently have statewide preemptions on inclusionary zoning, but we can and should do better. Local jurisdictions need the freedom to choose what tools are appropriate to improve housing stability in their communities. Developers and realtors are welcome to provide their input as it pertains to their particular market or local clients. Repealing the statewide ban on inclusionary zoning will at least provide local jurisdictions with an important tool that will help us achieve the goals of family stability, ending, at least in small part, racism and classism, and achieving the attainment of self-sufficiency. We urge your support for House Bill 2564. Thank you so much.
Thank you all very much. I really appreciate everybody coming, and it's a very important issue. We will, this is not the end of this session. It will be back. I am going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2564 and carry over to Thursday the work session on House Bill 2394, which is the lottery bill. Well, or do you guys want to do it right now? So Senator Olson, do people have a minute? Open up work session on House Bill 2394 because I listened to my vice chair. Representative Olson sent answers to the questions that we asked him.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2394A was previously heard.
And friends, well, we're still doing business here, so if you could wait to start your conversations until you leave the room.
Requires the state lottery to inform Department of Human Services within 7 days of paying a lottery price for $12.50 or more and declares an emergency effective on passage. And there was follow-up material provided by Representative Olson in answer to the questions asked.
And I have not had
you haven't?
Okay. Can we do it for
all right.
Thursday?
So we will hold that over till Thursday.
Okay.
So we are holding over House Bill 2394 to Thursday. I'm closing the work session on House Bill 2394. We're adjourned. Thank you all for your patience. We're adjourned. Thank you all for your patience.